Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
I was riding on the Mayflower when I thought I spied some lead.
Start again. I happened to be in the Parker Meridian Hotel, and Bob Dylan was on my floor. He called me up, and I'd known Bob a little bit, but we weren't like hangout buddies or anything. And
I don't know Bob even a little bit.
I was riding on the Mayflower, and I thought I spot some land.
A bit of Bob Dylan's 115th dream there, and a preview of a little dream come true for us yesterday. Actor Don Johnson, who it turns out is a friend of Dylan's, sat down and shared a whole bunch of stories about acting, about being famous in the 1980s as Detective Sonny Crockett on Miami Vice, and about his new movie, Cold in July. That's later this hour. We will also take a peek at Vladimir Putin's reading list and see if we can recognize his character anywhere in the novel War and Peace. Building on the success of legalized gambling, some Native American reservations consider legalized marijuana to boost local economies. The state of Colorado, where it's already legal, is already partying. We'll tell you about the Colorado Symphony's new concert series, Classically Cannabis, I kid you not, giving new meaning to the words orchestral score. But we are going to begin with the complicated question of government surveillance, government recordings, and the public record. Government recordings can be a priceless part of the historical record in the case of Lyndon Johnson's recorded White House phone conversations. Recordings can also bring down a president in the case of the Nixon White House Watergate tapes. They can violate the Constitution or disrupt relations between allies in the case of the NSA domestic surveillance and world leader phone intercepts discovered and made public by Edward Snowden nearly a year ago. And government recordings can also protect Americans. On July 11th, the Justice Department will begin to systematically record statements and interrogations in federal crime investigations. After resisting the practice for years, senior Justice Department officials are now strongly encouraging agents to videotape suspects and say there is a presumption that suspects in custody will now be recorded. Joining me now is Michael German, former FBI special agent, who's now a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice, Liberty, and National Security Program. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So as a former FBI special agent, what was the hesitation on these federal videotapes, and what do you think has changed here?
So part of the hesitation is just that the FBI is a very traditional organization that thinks they do things right. So if this is the way they've always done it, this is the way they're always going to do it. You know, there were some very slight, specious sort of arguments about, well, you know, sometimes in an interview you might have to lie to a suspect, and that might not be very well understood by a jury later on, and you'd have to explain that. So it's easier just to leave that to the FBI.
Yeah, it is easier
note.
To exactly. Leave that out. Yeah, right.
Exactly. So even where there wasn't necessarily impropriety, they just felt that it was easier and better for the prosecution if they just go by the agent's notes.
Is this about protecting suspects? Could it also be about protecting the investigators as well?
As far as the recording now,
yeah.
Yes. I think that this was long past due. I couldn't understand when I was in the FBI from 1988 to 2004 why we were so far behind the curve, because it does protect the agents. And as an agent, when you would go up to testify, because you're working from a summary of your notes, there was always this skepticism that the defense attorney could bring in saying, oh, you didn't record this interview. This isn't exactly what the person said. You didn't transcribe it. You know, these are just what you say he said. So it certainly will, I think, be better for both the agents and for the defendants. So it's just better for justice overall.
The USA Security Act passed the House this week, and there's all kinds of wiggle room in there about what the NSA can or can't do on collection of bulk data. Assess the wiggle room here in this memo from the Justice Department, which encourages agents to videotape suspects, and there is a presumption that there will be a videotaping. What's that all about?
Right. I mean, I think overall it's a net positive that presumptively and it only applies to custodial interrogation, so once a person has been arrested. So it's a very narrow policy, but it also has a couple of very problematic exceptions. One particular being the Quarles exception. This is the Supreme Court case that said that you could get public safety information without reading somebody their Miranda rights. So it came from a case where a person had a gun police chased him into a store, and when they arrested him, didn't have the gun anymore. So they knew he had dropped it somewhere in the store and said, hey, where's the gun? There are kids around here. Somebody could get hurt. And they allowed that statement. Well, now the FBI views that exception very broadly, that they can literally interview somebody for hours or even days based on that exception. So that isn't part of the recording policy is a very big problem. There's a national security exception, which, again, we've seen in NSA and other type programs that's used very broadly to cover a lot of government questionable contact, let's say.
Well, since you referenced the NSA once again, the framers had no idea that there was such thing as a record button in the days of the Constitution's drafting. Yet the law views very, very differently the times that the government may press record. When it's dealing with suspects, dealing with citizens, dealing with governments, other leaders, domestic or foreign individuals. Can you sort of sketch out how controversial it is for the government to ever press the record key?
Sure. I mean, it should be done in a way that protects the defendant to the best degree possible. So I did a lot of undercover work. And, of course, in the undercover work, there were a lot of recordings. But what I found was it kept me honest as well, I knew that my conduct was going to be evaluated afterwards. So it's certainly something that can protect both, but we want to make sure that it's only directed against people where the government suspects they're involved in wrongdoing. We don't want the government recording just anyone they can. That's not useful for the government because recording innocent people doesn't help you find guilty people.
Well, they don't necessarily believe that.
They don't, but when you review these programs, like you mentioned the NSA with the Section 215 telephone metadata program, never actually caught a terrorist. So, they've been gathering all this information for over a decade, yet it's not useful. Well, it's sort of common sense that if you're gathering information about innocent people, it doesn't help you find guilty people.
All this technology has changed the law, yes?
In dangerous ways and mostly secretly, which is really a problem, that we don't really have a great understanding of how it is the government's interpreting its authorities.
Very interesting. Michael German is a former FBI special agent who is now a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Mama's in a factory, she ain't got no shoes. Daddy's in the alley, he's looking for food. I'm in the kitchen with the tombstone blues.
The grisly prospect of more executions like the botched lethal injection in Oklahoma last month has gotten the attention of the U.S. Supreme Court. As states experiment with secret ingredients in their lethal injection drugs, lawyers are challenging the injections as cruelty, inflicting pain and suffering instead of the intended peaceful end. The high court is taking these challenges seriously. Meanwhile, Tennessee is considering an alternative. Last night, Tennessee's Republican Governor Bill Haslam signed a bill into law that would allow the state to bring back the electric chair in the event that they cannot obtain the drugs needed to administer lethal injection. Joining us now is Ed Pilkington, chief reporter for The Guardian. Ed, welcome.
Hi, great to be here.
Do you think we will see an electric chair execution in the next few years?
At the moment, I think we're still at the level of fantasy, though last night certainly brought it several stages closer to reality. The fact that the governor actually signed the law, it was really significant. It's the first time that a state has actually proposed imposing something like the electric chair or the firing squad, whereas other states, it still exists as an alternative that prisoners can choose. But this idea is in Tennessee is that they would actually use it and the prisoner would have no say in the matter. So that takes us one step closer to it happening. And I think it's just a sign of this crisis that is spreading across death penalty states at the moment.
And you've got this secrecy issue that has produced these problems like we saw in Oklahoma. Suddenly, the Supreme Court is very interested in this. It seems as though they're very, very uncertain about what's going on here. And states, including Tennessee, are basically trying to get out from underneath this whole lethal injection problem. We've got other states considering exactly what Tennessee did.
Yes, Wyoming has also started talking about bringing back the firing squad. It still exists in Utah, and they too are talking about actually bringing it forward as something that the state might impose upon prisoners. So you're starting to see in Missouri, which is one of the main death penalty states at the moment, has talked about rebuilding its gas chamber. So that there is this debate. It's starting to ripple up. It's becoming maybe more than a fantasy, and maybe we might start seeing action on it. And it's all as a result of the dearth of lethal injection drugs imposed by by a European-led boycott of the drugs.
I'm wondering if the law or if social norms have shifted in the years of lethal injections, in that even though there's, you know, firing squads are perfectly legal, are still legal in Utah, electric chairs, gas chambers were used in the 20th century, but to go back to them would be viewed now as barbaric.
Yes, I think what's happening is that the story of the death penalty of the last 40 years is starting to unravel. For the last 40 years, America's is trying to be squaring this circle, trying to be humane in the way that they kill people. And we're starting to find that that's coming apart because the medical profession is no longer playing ball. The pharmaceutical companies aren't playing ball. They're not allowing their drugs to go to the prison services. Doctors aren't playing ball. Nurses aren't playing ball. And as a result, the whole edifice that we can kill people judicially and humanely is starting to come apart. And when that happens, then people start thinking about, well, what else are we going to do?
It seems as though the only option here is to go back, in a sense, to Nazi Germany, which made a contract deal with a chemical company to produce Zyklon B, that essentially you'll have to have a government contractor to produce toxic substances.
Well, I think that's where the baseline lies. I mean, baseline, we're talking about what is the American people prepared to put up with? How far are they prepared to go in terms of what is done in their name? Now, rebuilding gas chambers, I think, would be incredibly difficult in this country after what happened in Germany. Using firing squads, well, you could say that's incredibly humane. The prisoner dies within seconds. They have four bullets in their heart. You don't survive something like that. Whereas in Oklahoma, we just saw a death that lasted 43 minutes. Mm. So you could say it's more humane, but will the American people be prepared to do that? Will they be prepared to see guns lined up and shot from 20 feet at a prisoner? I think it's hard to say.
I'm wondering if this is a way of forcing the issue. If states aren't really serious about electric chairs, but they're doing this as a way of forcing clarity either on the Supreme Court, the federal government, or the criminal code.
There's truth in that. I think death penalty states are trying anything they can think of. There's a sense of desperation spreading across these states because they don't have the drugs they need to kill the people they have scheduled to kill. And I think what's happening is a sense of such of sort of mayhem and randomness spreading in these states that eventually the Supreme Court, which has been fending off this subject quite markedly until now, I think the Supreme Court will be forced to deal with it.
Ed Pilkington is chief reporter for The Guardian on the transformation and crisis that exists in death penalty states in the United States. Ed, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Later this hour,
I always tell about this quote that I read about the Buddhist Bible or from Buddha or something. And I'm a student of Buddhism, but I'm a student of all philosophies.
Right.
Anyway, he said, the pearl of enlightenment isn't found just lying around on the beach. You have to open a lot of oysters, and you break your nails and scrub your knuckles, and you suffer and you suffer, and then after about 10,000 of them, you, bam, you open one and there it is.
Don Johnson on Zen Master advice he got from a certain Robert Zimmerman later this hour.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TiVo. Recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube. All on the TiVo Romeo DVR. TiVo.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Darkness at the break of noon, shadows, even the silver spoon, the handmade blade, the child's balloon, eclipses both the sun and moon, to understand you know too soon, there's no sense in trying.
A living symbol of the shameful historical legacy of American exploitation, domination, and abandonment of Native Americans can be found on the Lakota Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota.
Historically, Shannon County, which is where the reservation is located in southwestern South Dakota, has been one of the poorest counties in the country, ranking everywhere between 1 and 5 consistently for decades. And the tribe has been looking for alternative ways of raising revenue, of creating jobs.
That's Brandon Ekafee, managing editor of Native Sun News. He's a member of the Oglala Lakota tribe. And he's talking about conditions that have motivated the tribe to think about legalizing marijuana as a possible boost to the local economy in the same way that tribes have benefited from legalized gambling.
In the past, there's always been a kind of a generational divide on marijuana between younger Americans and older Americans. Well, on the reservation, that divide doesn't seem to exist. I think a community that's been hit so hard by mass incarceration, by poverty, by, you know, a number of social afflictions, finding something that might work is appealing to everybody.
Around the country, at least two dozen other tribes are considering similar proposals. Newsweek correspondent Ian McDougall has explored the implications of these possible changes, joins us now. Ian, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So what would happen if, from coast to coast, reservations actually adopted this?
The first issue would be that marijuana would remain illegal under federal law, under the Controlled Substances Act. And the federal government, in the case of states like Colorado and Washington, has said, well, it remains illegal, we will not prosecute as long as you find ways to regulate this carefully, make sure kids don't get access to it, make sure it doesn't go to states where it's illegal. The tribes presumably would be subject to the same kind of requirements in order for the Justice Department not to prosecute under federal law, which would mean they would have to set up, as Colorado and Washington have, very elaborate regulatory and enforcement regimes. And it's not clear that even if that happens, the federal government would give them the same courtesy, I guess, because in this memorandum, interestingly, it's not – tribes aren't mentioned. Only state and local governments are mentioned. People often talk about the U.S. as a place of dual sovereignty, states and federal, but they forget it's triple sovereignty. Really.
Triple sovereignty,
tribes,
right,
as well.
Exactly. In Colorado and Washington State, where marijuana is already legalized to a certain extent, what would be the status there? They'd be able to sell tax-free or outside the regulatory regime within those legalized states?
That becomes a complicated question. In Colorado, as in South Dakota, the tribes, the reservations are totally separate, and they would – so even though you legalize it in Colorado, it's not legalized on the reservation in Colorado. About half of the reservations or so are in states governed by this complicated statute that was came about in, I think, the 50s, where there's sort of this concurrent state tribal jurisdiction when it comes to criminal matters. So Washington is dealing with that now. Some of the reservations there are saying, we don't want marijuana to be legal on our reservation, but they are partly under state criminal jurisdiction, so it becomes a difficult question. But in most states, that wouldn't be the case.
Economically, is there any way to measure what the possible benefit would be at a place like Pine Ridge in South Dakota?
It's hard to say. I mean, for something like Colorado, it's been tremendous. In January and February, I think it was something like $6 million in tax revenue in Colorado alone. What people who have studied this a little bit or thought about it have said to me is that you have kind of a Scylla and Charybdis situation where on one hand, in order for it to be profitable to get kind of scale, you'd need to really make serious revenue. You'd have to have a fairly sort of open, you know, a lot of people coming in, fairly easy to get access to it. But on the other hand, if you do that, you run the risk of federal enforcement.
Right. And, I mean, yeah. So you couldn't on Pine Ridge create, you know, a Podorama, you know, the drive-in mall that you could, right, you know, just hit on Route 80 there.
In theory, I guess you could, but yeah, the problem would be you'd have to have some way of preventing people from coming in, buying it, and then moving on. And for an area three times the size of Rhode Island, there are only, I think, 51 tribal police officers. And in January, they had to ask the BIA, the federal government, to come in and help them because they had too few police officers on the reservation.
Is the legalization of gambling on reservations a decent model for anticipating how this would work if it were actually implemented?
It is, in the sense that it's something that would be, in theory, grown. Everything would be created on the reservation. So unlike cigarettes, tax-free cigarettes, which have been more problematic because they have to be brought in from elsewhere, it is analogous. The other thing is you'd run into the same problem. So Pine Ridge, for example, has a casino, Prairie Wind, that has had a hard time really generating a lot of revenue, unlike reservations near, say, Phoenix or near here in Connecticut, where you're near big areas, major highways. When you're on a reservation, as many of them are, in the middle of nowhere, it's hard to really get a lot of people to come there.
Is there controversy within the tribes about doing this, whether it's a good idea or not?
Absolutely. I mean, that's people have told me that there's a lot of concern. These two dozen or so, maybe more, tribes that are thinking about this, there's a lot of fear of the feds cracking down and them making an example of whichever tribe decides to pull the trigger first on this.
And would Pine Ridge possibly be first in line?
It could be. It seems like the proposal right now is stalled. It's not clear exactly where it's going to go. They're still pushing for it, but there, I think, a lot of pushback has come from this fear of what will happen if they do this.
I'm wondering if the political orders in various states are inclined to wait and see, because certainly states outside the reservations have benefited from the economic development, particularly you cited Connecticut there, of the growth of casinos. Mohegan Sun and Foxwoods in Connecticut have benefited businesses inside and outside the reservation.
That's certainly a possibility. I think, on the other hand, there's a great deal of wariness about this diversion issue, both at least for Pine Ridge, both Nebraska and South Dakota, which the reservation borders, have not legalized marijuana at all. So I think there is a countervailing concern there.
Ian McDougall is a correspondent for Newsweek looking at the implications of the legalization of marijuana on Native American reservations around the U.S. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up next, the Colorado Symphony has a marijuana-inspired concert series, a new effort in Colorado to get folks to watch classical music, which inspires our friend and WQXR host, Jeff Spurgeon.
Bright colors, big emotions, the thrill can be overwhelming. It's amazing what happens to the brain when you're on music. This thing is already in 3D high-def Technicolor. Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe, a ballet about the mythical shepherds. She narrowly escapes ravaging pirates. He narrowly escapes captivity and drowning. And when they're reunited, it sounds like the whole earth rejoices in psychedelic orchestral colors. It'll blow your mind, even without blunt force.
Thank you, Jeff Spurgeon of WQXR. Coming up, a discussion of the Cannabis Concert Series in Colorado.
Pissed on you when you're trying to go home. They'll pissed on you when you're there all alone.
Thank you for that, Mr. Dylan. Another popular anthem of sex, drugs, and Hector Berlioz? That's right. Opium inspired with an absinthe chaser, Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique is just one of the possible numbers on the program as the Colorado Symphony kicks off their musical series, Classically Cannabis, the High Note series, tonight. It's a private fundraising series in partnership with Denver's growing and newly legal marijuana industry. Scott O'Neill is the resident conductor of the Colorado Symphony and joins us now. Welcome, Scott.
Hi, John.
So, Scott, I thought you guys, you conductors, don't like it when people cough in the audience during concerts.
We do like silence, that's for sure.
And what's the idea here? You're not expecting people to actually be getting stoned in the audience, right?
That's correct. You know, there's a partnership with the cannabis industry here. It's still not legal to partake in public, so that's the official line.
But have you been thinking about the kind of music that you would program with the idea that people would be, you know, slightly altered in that Berlioz state, perhaps?
Absolutely, especially, you know, the private events that we will be doing, that it is possible to do that. So we've got ideas coming from all angles.
And this is really an important mission already for the symphony, attracting younger people to classical music concerts, right?
I would say that, but I'd also hesitate to maybe place that out of proportion. The folks that I know that are going to, especially the first event with the art gallery, you know, they're 30-something, 40-something, they're well-educated and fairly comfortably placed on the socioeconomic scale. So I hope people don't get the idea that, oh, it's going to be a bunch of deadbeat teenagers. That's also not accurate.
How controversial was it to go down this road? Is this your idea? Did somebody come to you with this idea?
When cannabis was legalized, there's a lot of crossover in the development communities between these organizations, so it's just kind of natural that the conversations took place. It's as far as I know, you know, when I asked, well, who, did they come to us? Did we go to them? It was just a series of conversations between the two organizations, and, you know, cannabis has actually reached out to other arts organizations here, and they've actually done some events, but much more privately than we've done, so that's where I think some of the attention has risen.
And you've got all the lava lamps ready for the concert? And
well, the the concert we're doing at Red Rocks, I don't count on any lava lamps, but if people want to bring them, those are certainly legal.
Right, those are legal. And, you know, you could really...
They are legal.
Yeah, they are totally legal, exactly. And, you know, orchestral score, you know, play the numbers on the program. I mean, you can really just get really dumb here, right?
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see what... direction it takes, but so far the event that I'm aware of, the Space Gallery, is one where people will be able to smoke in like a courtyard patio area, and then the idea is that they'll be listening to classical music and looking at contemporary art while they're doing their thing.
All very high-minded, right, Scott? Scott O'Neill, the resident conductor of the Colorado Symphony, which begins its Classically Cannabis, the High Note series tonight. Thanks so much, Scott.
Thank you.
Tickets, please.
Friday movies for Memorial Day weekend, the first big blockbuster weekend of the summer. And we've got Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway, co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Rafer. Welcome, guys.
Hi, John.
Happy Memorial Day weekend.
Thanks, you too.
And to you.
Yes, indeed. And let's talk about the movies this weekend. I mean, this is the big blockbuster, and we've got two of them, one comedy and one, well, X-Men. That's all you really need to say. Let's talk about the movie Blended. First, here's a clip.
Lightly brush your fingers against her skin. Oh, God. What's happening? Is there a bug on me?
No, there's no bug. I was just trying to get some skin,
well,
like she said.
That hurts the jugular.
Sorry. I don't know. Yeah.
All right. I don't quite get the premise of this film, and I've seen the trailers. I still don't get the premise of it, and Adam Sandler, quite frankly, scares me as a dad in this movie. What do you think, Kristen?
You know, you shouldn't be that confused. It's pretty straightforward. It's a little bit Brady Bunch. You have a guy with three kids. You have a woman with two kids. They're totally mismatched. They're set up on a blind date. Things aren't going to work out. But somehow, through crazy, crazy circumstances, they end up in South Africa on a blended family vacation together. And maybe they'll learn to love each other and love each other's kids. And you know how it goes.
Looking at the trailers, I didn't think Brady Bunch even once, Rafer. Does this work for you?
Is that right? Well, it's Brady Bunch minus one. It's three girls and two boys. Maybe that threw you off.
does this work?
You know, I have to say I really like Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore together as a couple. This is their third film together. Wedding Singer, 51st Dates, Blended. They have a certain chemistry. They fit together nicely. And although the movie is very predictable and pretty obvious, they really make it work. It's got a little sparkle, a little heart to it. I liked it.
He's been box office, not recently. Do you think he will be this time around?
I kind of hope so, because I also thought there was a nice little sparkle in this movie. It has a heart. Rafer and I discussed it earlier. He thinks it's a little bit too heteronormative in lots of ways, which it is. But despite that, there's something really special that shines through that feels kind of legitimately sweet in it.
I did not use the word heteronormative.
Did she say heteronormative?
I just want to point that out.
Heteronormative. What are you trying to get in the New York Times, Kristen Meinzer? Heteronormative.
Exactly.
Three heteronormatives. Speaking of heteronormative, X-Men, Days of Future Past.
I said the school's closed. You need to leave.
Not until I see the professor.
There's no professor here. I told you that.
Look, kid. You and I are going to be good friends.
Ooh, Hugh Jackman in X-Men Days of Future Past. Nothing normative about this movie here. What did you think, Kristen?
Well, you got to go back to the past to stop the war on the mutants that's happening in the present. And Hugh Jackman, of course, is always just magnetic on screen. It's hard not to enjoy him. It's hard not to enjoy these costumes because it all takes place in 1973. And to see the younger and the older versions of all the X-Men is also great fun. One warning, I'd say don't think about logic at all. Once you start thinking about time-traveling logic, you might get a little confused and derailed. But if you just go with it, I think it's a pretty enjoyable ride.
Did you go with it?
I totally went with it. I always like the X-Men films. They're really one of the smartest and cleverest and most well-drawn superhero franchises around. They're not too dark. They're not too winky and jokey. I think they walk a great line between being intelligent and also just great
Rock'em Sock'em Entertainment. And as Kristen was saying, the 1973 fashions are terrific.
So they avoided the whole Go Matrix and the sequel kind of incomprehensibility problem.
You know, again, if you don't think too terribly hard, I mean, what you really have, if you want to get technical, is the Wolverine's consciousness has been sent back in time into his younger body. So that sort of explains a few things, I suppose. But
people
overall,
go to the gym to do that, right?
These days. Right. Yeah. That's right. But it does work. I think it's a lot of fun.
All right. So what about the podcast this weekend?
Well, we were very fortunate to sit down with the editor and composer of X-Men Days of Future Past. His name is John Ottman. He wears two hats, and he's been working very closely with Bryan Singer on all the X-Men movies throughout the years.
Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway, producer of the Sporkful podcast, and Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. They are co-hosts of the Movie Date podcast. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, John.
The present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last. For the times, they are a-changing.
Now, why would we choose to play classic Bob Dylan tunes this hour to set up our conversation with actor and classic 80s TV star Don Johnson? Well, just go with me here.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you...
As Detective Sonny Crockett on Miami Vice, Don Johnson was at one point as famous as Dylan, but that's not the point. Johnson has a new movie coming out playing a Texas detective named Jim Bob from the 80s in a dark, complex story of violence and fear called Cold in July. Johnson is part of a blockbuster cast in the film that includes Sam Shepard and Michael C. Hall from the series Dexter. These days, acting is much preferred to celebrity in Johnson's life. From playing the father in the absurd comedy Eastbound and Down to playing a plantation owner, Big Daddy in Django Unchained, Johnson likes contrasts, he says, exactly why he was drawn to Cold in July.
It's dark, but it's also funny. And I deliver some comic relief in it that I don't think you're expecting at the beginning. And the author of the book that this is based on, Joe Lansdale, he gave me the foundation for how to build the character. And it was, he said, Jim Bob Luke never met a problem he couldn't solve and probably wouldn't know a problem if he saw one. And I liked that. That gave me a lot to work with.
There's a great scene that reminds me of a stage play where you discover this awful videotape of this pornographic, I guess it's a snuff film, where they kill somebody with a baseball bat.
Yeah.
And we discover that the character in the tape is the son of Sam Shepard.
Mm.
And I mean, there's more to play in the mystery, but at that point, you decide – he can't know this. He's searching for his son, but he can't know about this.
But we can't tell Ben about any of it. Not yet.
About what?
It ain't nothing we need to jump into right now.
What's on the tape? What's on the tape?
Do yourself a favor, Hoss.
And the whole thing turns around. And you know, suddenly this very tough convict character, Sam Shepard, is like filled with a sense of remorse and just this is over the top for him.
Mm.
It was an amazing transformation in a very short period of time.
Yeah. But that's one of the things that I like about the movie as a whole and why I decided to make it. So many films I look at these days, I know what's going to happen by page 10 or 11. And I think we do that as viewers. You turn on the television or you go to the movies and by the third or fourth scene, you may enjoy it even, but you know where it's going. And in Cold in July, you have no idea where it's going, and it just keeps changing and keeps transitioning and surprising you and entertaining you, and at once funny and at once uncomfortable, but gripping throughout. You're from opening to close. It's that way, and I like those kinds of challenging transitions of being able to walk the razor's edge and go from comedy to very dark emotional challenges.
Well, it was as disorienting as No Country for Old Men. You know, the first time I saw that, I had no idea where that was headed.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, it's similar kind of characters. This is also a real step back to the 80s. I mean, you got the first cell phones. There's a couple of cell phone jokes that you do there. The cars are amazing. It's kind of the 70s cars that survived into the 80s. And
None of those damn cars actually drove either. We, we either had to push them or tow them or something.
There's a Ford Pinto joke in here.
Something, somewhere. Yeah. I like that period of time, particularly because it was pre-cell phones, or the cell phones that we were carrying around were as big as a shoebox. And pre-PC, pre-social media and networks and those sorts of things. So the communication has to be by other means. But, I like that period because it's just before everything started to change dramatically.
No, that's really true. That's really true. So what kind of roles do you – I mean, aside from the work that is close to your heart, what kind of – stuff you get asked to do?
The other reason that I like this is it wasn't a dad role.
Right.
I got to play something other than somebody's dad, and that's what you get offered a lot when you get to be a more mature member of the acting public.
Yes, exactly.
I'm getting some interesting
opportunities. Plantation owner, right?
That was a good one. And Django Unchained was a lot of fun, and I was honored to be asked to be in the movie because he's a film auteur genius, and he's a unique voice in film, like Hunter Thompson was to journalism, Quentin Tarantino is to film.
It's interesting.
And I try to find characters, directors, and people to work with who actually know how to tell stories rather than use the convenience of the public persona.
Mm-hmm. How hard was that to learn as a performer, as a father, as a man, you know, this sort of conflict between one's life and one's sort of public persona, the cheap hook?
Well, I'll tell you, I was very fortunate. I'll tell you a quick story. In the 80s, when I was pretty much at the zenith of Miami Vice, Sonny Crockett mania, I happened to be in the Parker Meridian Hotel uptown there.
Yep.
And Bob Dylan was on my floor. He called me up, and I'd known Bob a little bit, but we weren't like hangout buddies or anything. And
I don't know Bob even a little bit.
He's a trip. I got to know him really well. But he called me up, and I was a little surprised. I went, How you doing? I went, well, I'm Bob. I'm good. How you doing? And he says, I was wondering if you could give me a ride down to my sister's. And I said, okay, where's your sister? He said, downtown. And I said, sure. And on the way downtown in the ride, he was talking to me, and we were talking about careers and stuff like that and singing and how I started singing in my grandfather's church. And he said, well, let me ask you something. Would Don Johnson do such and such and such and such? Because Bob Dylan wouldn't do such and such and such and such. And I went, what in the hell is it? Why is he talking about Bob Dylan and Don Johnson in the third person? And it took me some time after that to realize that Bob had figured it out, that his product, his brand, his public persona of Bob Dylan had nothing to do with who he really was as a human being. And he was giving me a clue as to learn how to separate Don Johnson, the public persona, from who I truly am, which is neither Don Johnson nor any other kind of normal ego-based identity.
Huh. That's a great story.
I don't know if I've ever told it so articulately.
Well, Don, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Don Johnson plays Jim Bob in the new movie Cold in July, out in theaters today.
Come, you masters of war. Here that build the big guns.
We leave you with War and Peace to think about heading into this holiday weekend. It's an election weekend for the people of Ukraine and not likely to be peaceful, with already 13 dead this week in pre-election violence in pro-Russian eastern Ukrainian cities. As the world waits for Russia's Vladimir Putin to make good on his pledge to withdraw troops from Ukraine's eastern border, Russia's military chief has criticized the buildup of NATO troops in Poland and the Baltic nations. At a news conference, Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov has blamed the entire crisis on what he termed Western megalomania, Vladimir Putin himself agreed with that assessment at a news conference today, said he only wanted peace in Ukraine, but he doubted that the upcoming elections would be, in his words, legitimate. The people of Ukraine going to vote, seeking peace but caught in a dramatic confrontation between faraway generals and megalomaniacs. Sounds like a Russian novel. Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, what might be on the reading stand of Vladimir Putin this weekend? Sun Tzu's Art of War, a book about chess? Andrew Kaufman, lecturer in the Department of Slavic Languages and Literatures at the University of Virginia, says Putin is a character right out of Russian literature. Kaufman suggests that Putin might not recognize himself in Dostoevsky or Tolstoy, but Kaufman does.
Well, he says there's two favorite writers. I'm not convinced he's read either one of them that deeply, particularly recently. But as I think about, you know, the influences that both of these writers may have had on him, Dostoevsky was fundamentally a nationalist. He believed that Russia had a unique destiny to unite and lead the nations of the world, particularly the Slavic nations. And that is kind of a rhetoric that we hear in a lot of Putin's speeches, particularly lately. Tolstoy didn't believe in that at all. Tolstoy was completely a universalist. And one of the core messages of his art is the unique genius and the individuality of every human being and every culture. And I think Putin has gotten away from the Tolstoyan narrative, as has much of Russian politics in the past several years.
Well, Tolstoy certainly embraces the pageantry of old Russia in many of his books, but he certainly describes in unflinching terms the absolute fallibility of political leaders. It would be a cautionary tale for Putin to read War and Peace at this stage, yes?
Absolutely. In fact, as I think about all of the characters in War and Peace, the one that Putin most closely resembles is not the Russian commander-in-chief, Kutuzov, but rather the French aggressor, Napoleon. And Napoleon's invasion of Russia and his ultimate conquest of Moscow, which ultimately led to his destruction and the destruction of his army and then Napoleonic France, is one of the great cautionary tales about the dangers of hubris.
The interesting thing about the military characters, the Russian military characters in Tolstoy, these are the guys who are the real sort of not softies, but the ones who embrace, everyone, embrace all the races and diversities within Russia. Kutuzov is a real tolerant leader. Prince Andrei is someone who really is very humble about war and not arrogant about conquest.
Well, Prince Andrei is a very good example. In War and Peace, he is the one character that wants to be like Napoleon. He is a glory seeker, and in fact, he dreams that he is going to single-handedly lead Russians to victory on the battlefield at the Battle of Austerlitz. And one of the first things that happens to him is he gets whacked over the head by an enemy soldier's bayonet. He's landed on the ground. He's lying prostrate on the battlefield of Austerlitz, and he looks up and he sees the glorious sky. And he wonders, how is it I've never noticed that sky before? And the reason he's never noticed that sky before is because he was so caught up in his own self-aggrandizing plans. He was so caught up in his own hubris. And it wasn't until he realized that he's just a very small part of this universe that he was actually able to enjoy the beauty of the universe that he'd never noticed before.
And does Pierre figure at all into Vladimir Putin, the amazing character of Pierre in War and Peace?
I don't know if he figures into Putin. Pierre is the survivor. In some ways, Pierre beautifully embodies one of my favorite quotes from War and Peace. Tolstoy wrote that there is no greatness where there is no simplicity, goodness, and truth. And what he meant by that is there are so many forces in our lives, social forces, war, spiritual confusion, that are acting upon us. And yet we always have the choice about how we're going to live each moment. Life is what happens to us. Destiny is what we do with it. And Pierre is a great embodiment of someone who has been through just the savagery of war. He's been through a long, harrowing experience, and yet he's continually keeping that moral compass, keeping his moral dignity, and living with goodness and simplicity in each moment.
You know, we've talked for several minutes about Tolstoy without mentioning any of the extraordinary women characters, some of the most powerful women in literature. What lessons could a Vladimir Putin, who is about as male as it gets there in Russia, from the women in Tolstoy?
Well, some of the women characters in War and Peace are among my favorite characters. Natasha Rostova is a great example. Natasha is one of the heroes of the book. And there's a scene later on in the novel when she's lost somebody very dear to her, and she's wallowing in her own self-pity. She's at home, still with her family. She's still, you know, in her late teens. And she thinks that nobody can understand her pain. No one can appreciate what she's going through. Everything is so humdrum. And then she and her family get the news that one of her brothers has just been killed in war. And in an instant, she is transformed into an adult because she sees her father crying, she sees her mother crying, and she realizes that they need her as much as she needs them. And one of the great lessons that she embodies in that moment is that we are all on this journey together. The universality of human experience is so beautifully illustrated by characters like Natasha, as well as Princess Maria and other characters in War and Peace.
Maybe the takeaway here is that it would be well of Americans to maybe take a look at Tolstoy and Dostoevsky as a way of understanding what motivates Putin, but also how this whole Ukraine crisis is going down among Russians who probably know these books by heart.
Oh, I absolutely think Russian literature in particular is a great source of understanding of many of the cultural roots and the psychological roots of what's going on today in Russia. The drama that's being played out in Russia right now is not just a geopolitical drama. In many ways, it's a drama of the Russian soul. Putin is grappling with a question that so many of the great 19th century Russian writers grappled with in their art, which is, what is the source of our national greatness? And, you know, one answer is the answer of hubris. The other answer is, I think, the Tolstoyan response of humility. And so much of what is happening today in Russia can be understood through the lens of the Russian soul, which is beautifully depicted in the classics of Russian literature.
Andrew Kaufman is author of Give War and Peace a Chance, Tolstoyan Wisdom for Troubled Times. He's a lecturer in the Department of Slavic Languages and Literature at the University of Virginia. Thanks so much, Andrew.
Thank you, John.
And so we turn to you at the end of this hour. What books should be on Putin's summer reading list, huh?
Hi, my name's Amy from East Providence, Rhode Island. And the book that I wish Vladimir Putin would read is Nonviolent Communication by Marshall Rosenberg. He probably won't read it, but if he would, it might just open his eyes a crack to other people's viewpoints.
We want to remind you about our summer reading list. Our summer book club kicks off next month. The first book we're reading is To Rise Again at a Decent Hour by Joshua Ferris. We'll hear a review of that book on Monday, and we invite you to read along with us. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great Memorial Day weekend out there on Highway 61. Oh, and happy birthday, Bob. It's his birthday tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results, because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com. TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen. Available at TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.